Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, welcome to Beyond the Book at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. My name is Christopher Keneally, and apart from serving as CCC's Director of Author and Creator Relations, I also plead guilty to having written some books. Or actually, one and a half books. The real one was A History of Massachusetts, and the other one, as I like to say, the half a book was a guidebook to my hometown of Boston. And indeed, I am from Boston. It may be hard to tell. And I think it's interesting to be here in Philadelphia because, of course, we share in common Benjamin Franklin. You guys got the better part of the bargain because, of course, he left Boston when he was about 16 or 17 and came down here. Luckily, though, we kept Sam Adams. Now, I want to ask a serious question. How many of you here in the audience today have attended a writer's conference or any kind of creator's conference before? That's good. And you still came to this one. That's the surprise, I think. Because if you're like me, you've attended a lot of those kinds of conferences, and what you've heard about is how to write or how to take photographs. And you already know how to do that. I think what you really want to get out of a conference, what I've always wanted to get out of a conference, was how to make a living at it, how to be successful. And that's what we're going to try to help share with you this afternoon, the business of writing and creating. There's a warning I want to give you, though. We're not going to tell you how to make $1 million at it. I attended a conference once where it opened up with how to make six figures as a freelance writer. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. I want to go there and get the formula. The formula they gave you, and I'm only slightly paraphrasing, was have a really great idea and get very lucky. Okay? There's a lot more to it than that. That's not a business plan that anybody would invest in. And what I'd like to suggest is the information we're going to share with you today is about the real points of a real business plan. I think it's fitting, too, that we're here at the National Constitution Center, one of the country's newest and, I think, most exciting museums, because the founders really did care a great deal about not only writing, but reading. They were well-read people. They understood history. And they tried to learn from it when they were shaping the Constitution. They perhaps didn't learn quite enough, but they certainly put us on a pretty good footing. So again, thank you all for coming. There are members of American Society of Media Photographers here, the National Writers Union. We have faculty from the University of Pennsylvania, a wide range of people, and we do look forward to an exciting afternoon. I want to get started by starting to talk with Jeffrey Seglin. Jeffrey Seglin is an assistant professor at Emerson College in Boston, where he is director of the graduate program in publishing and writing. He teaches courses that include magazine publishing, the editor-writer relationship, professional ethics, and so forth. He was an ethics fellow at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies in 2001 and a resident fellow at the Center for the Study of Values in Public Life at Harvard University in 1998. Jeff has written or co-authored more than a dozen books on business and writing, including The Good, the Bad, and Your Business, Choosing Right When Ethical Dilemmas Pull You Apart, and most recently, a book called The Right Thing, Conscience, Profit, and Personal Responsibility in Today's Business, which is a collection of the columns that he writes monthly for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Welcome, Jeff Seglin. And in fact, Jeff, you know, I have to confess, I put you up first here on the discussion because I thought we would get the really serious part of the program out of the way and get to the fun afterwards.
Thanks.
So we're going to have to talk about ethics a little bit. And the first question that occurs to me is, doesn't doing the right thing slow you down? Isn't it a complicated process of choosing to do right?
Well, yeah. It's doing the right thing does slow you down, but so does any critical decision making about anything. I think when people assume that they can make ethical decisions about something based on common sense, I think that's where we run into some kind of difficulties, because I think it does take work. One of the reactions I get to from my students who have taken the professional ethics course, after they've taken it and gone out to work in magazines or in publishing, is just how nice it is to sit around in the classroom and talk about all this stuff. And then when you get there and you have to put out a monthly magazine or a daily newspaper, it's a lot different. You're trying to make reactions and to make decisions much more quickly. So I think while it slows things down, it doesn't mean it stops you from doing your job. I think the idea I would like to think is that most of us think intelligently about the choices we make.
And it's not simply a matter of right and wrong. You've told me that it's really something, again, that's why I think it's complicated. And we'll focus on writing in a moment, but very generally, to behave ethically is to be forced to choose between right and right.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things that people end up talking about when they talk about ethical decisions is the decisions that are easy to make are those that are very, very clear-cut. The black and white decisions are easy. You know what's or the right and wrong decisions. If you know something's wrong, and a lot of us know what's wrong, we know that killing a guy is wrong. Well, actually, murdering a guy is wrong. And all of us can agree on that. Few people are going to argue with it. But it's when the decision, when you have a choice among a lot of different right choices you can make about how to interview a subject for a story, how to position a story, what kind of picture to publish with the story, those kind of decisions become complicated because there isn't really a wrong answer, there's a better answer. So you have to make a choice about what the right choice is at that point. I think one of the challenges, and the thing when you talk about slowing it down, I don't think it slows it down. The worst thing would be that if you make these decisions would be to allow it to cripple you in making any kind of decision. I'm not suggesting that, and I don't think that is involved with ethical decision making. I think the challenge is that we're all operating in gray areas, usually. That's where the difficulty is that there's no clear-cut right choice. If there was, then we'd all do the right thing, or most of us would do the right thing, and probably it would be a lot much more boring a place to be.
Well, gray area sounds like a kind of an excuse for everything is relative, though, and that's not what you mean either, is it?
No, I don't think everything's relative. I don't think that I think there was a... No, I don't think everything's relative. I don't think all of us can be left to our own choices about deciding what's right or wrong without any kind of sense of what the effect is on other people. I think there are some norms that we sort of established are just wrong. Making up people when you write about them, when you're writing nonfiction is wrong, even if you get great joy out of doing that, or if it makes the story a better one to tell.
Well, what I'm fascinated by is that, with the internet today, some things that were obviously wrong before are just so much easier to do now than ever, and that perhaps the temptation as a result is greater than ever. Do you agree or not?
I don't know if it's a temptation. My son teaches high school English, and he was telling me the story about a young student, because they're young students in high school, and he said that he got an essay from her, and it didn't read quite right because she wasn't one of his better students. And he got the essay, and then apparently the high school had this plagiarism software, which I guess matches up through the internet, passages, common passages. So he plugged the story in to the computer, and sure enough, it matched up, and the essay was on the internet. And the student had presumably just lifted it right off the internet and used the paper. So he confronted her the next day and said, "I want to show you something." And he brought her to the computer and said, "How do you explain this?" And she looked at the computer and she said, "How did she get my paper?" And I think one of the things that it does, the internet does allow us to do that type of thing, but it also allows us the mechanism to catch that type of thing. So while people may be tempted to do that, I remember in college the fraternity houses had files full of papers, and you'd hear stories of professors who had gone to that college ending up being given their paper that they had written 20 years before. I mean, you hear those stories, you just hear them more now because that stuff's more widely available, but it's also easier to catch that type of thing.
I think that's a good point. While it's easier to steal, if you will, it's also very easy to check and find out whether this is the person's work or not.
Right, and it's changed things. I mean, there are people, I remember you and I actually came up around the same time writing freelance in the Boston media, and I remember when I would write, I was 25 years ago, 20 years ago, when I was writing for Boston Magazine personal finance stuff. It was very easy for me then to sell a very similar article to Philadelphia Magazine, and then to New Jersey Monthly Magazine. And now that they're all on the internet, they're not that interested in doing that because those stories are widely available. So it does change markets as well, and it changes the way we approach our work.
And I would think, is in addition, that for editors, there's an even greater responsibility to, if you will, X-ray a manuscript. I mean, if a book comes to you from somebody you don't already know or trust, if you're an editor, it really is almost a requirement now to look really closely and be sure that the work is that person's work.
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about this. For one thing, all the high-profile cases that we've heard about in the last three or four years, the Stephen Glass case, the Jason Blair case, those weren't identified from within the organization. Those were identified from someone who was outside the organization. In the Stephen Glass case at the New Republic, it was a reporter at Forbes. In Jason Blair's case, I believe it was a writer in Texas
who
noticed that her stories were being picked up. And she had actually been a fellow intern with Jason Blair at the time. So, but that newspaper told the Times what was going on. So it isn't happening. It may be the responsibility of the editors in-house to police this stuff, but most often where these things sort of come to light, at least the high-profile stuff, is from people watching on from outside. So I would like to think that editors hire people that they can trust, but at some point, and I would like to think they put mechanisms in place that allow for them to sort of screen that type of stuff, but at some point you have to get a newspaper out or you have to get a magazine out, and you want to trust the people who are working for you. So it's good that material is so widely available now, because it not only gives people in-house a chance to monitor that, it gives people in Texas or far afield to the ability to look at that stuff and monitor if it looks funny.
Your collection, The Right Thing, looks at a variety of issues in business ethics. Some people ask whether, in fact, that's an oxymoron. And it may be simply that there's some very special ways of looking at the world as a business person. Do you have advice for thinking ethically in the business of writing and publishing that you'd want to share with writers? Is there any special key to behaving? You said to be sure to check. I mean, you need to just always be sure you ask yourself the important questions. Am I doing the right thing?
I think don't lie is
right.
Probably a good thing. I think, you know, one of the things that I come back to, and it's applicable in business or in publishing of any type, is values, codes of ethics, any of that type of stuff. They're only as good as the people who are within the organization. I did bring something with you that I printed off the internet this morning, and it's a values code from a well-known business, and basically the four values that this company holds in high regard are respect, integrity, communication, and excellence. And it's from Enron, which is the company that has been in the news lately with all the corporate fraud. And if you take the respect, integrity, communication, and excellence, the acronym for that is RICE, and it's just very well known that became everybody's values code, where it was those, because it was easy to remember, I guess. So companies have those. It's valueless if the top executives aren't going to follow it, if people at newspapers can't find the code of ethics, let alone know what's in it, and you'd find that's more often the case than you would hope, then those things are going to be valueless. So I think it's important that within publishing companies and within organizations that get ideas out, that people know what the culture is and what's acceptable. It's made clear what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And that takes leadership on the top. Reinforced all the way down to
well, that's what I was just thinking, that if you have a relationship as a writer to an editor, you really do, I think, want to maintain that relationship, and that starts with honesty. Any kind of relationship you have with a friend or a business partner always really has to start there with honesty. You can't expect to continue working with that person over time if you're going to try to deceive them about a work or not be truthful that you have a relationship with the person you've interviewed and so forth. It really is, honesty does come first.
Well, I think honesty does come first. It does. I think it's a very competitive world for writers and for editors, and it's very tough to make a living doing that type of business. That said, there are very talented people out there, and the temptation may be there. The temptations are there for all of us to cut corners and to get ahead and to get more notice than we could. But in the end, you start living a life that you never wanted to live in the first place, and it's just not worth it. I mean, at the base level, it's just not worth it to live that kind of life, because lies have a tendency to sort of feed on themselves, and you start telling the lies to protect the other lies, and it's just not worth it.
Okay, well that seems clear enough, then. We're all going to be very honest.
But, and we're not going to murder people.
Right. Yeah. But when we're negotiating, we have to get a book contract. There's a degree to which you don't need to reveal everything either. Honesty mm-hmm. does not require when the editor... Or does it? Let me ask you that. I mean, if you're negotiating and the editor says or the publisher says, well, how well did your last book do?
There's this... I'm going to evade the question. There's a woman who wrote a book called Lying, a woman named Cicela Bach. And she has referred subsequent to that to something called truth dumping. And that's the idea that... you can make a choice not to tell there's absolutely no obligation to tell everybody everything in explicit detail every time. That's not a lie. That's just, there are reasons, there are inhumane reasons for doing that. If you're trying to describe an illness to a patient, there's critical information for them to know. They don't need to know in excruciating detail, step by step, what that process is going to be like. So she talks about that. I think in negotiation, I think there are certain things that are acceptable to do in negotiating, and similar to the way that you buy any car other than a Saturn. The understanding is that there's going to be a give and take back and forth, and there is going to be a negotiation where you're going to ask for the world, and the publisher's going to want to give you, you know, not the world, as you go back and forth. I mean, that's why a lot of writers get agents, because it's such an unpleasant thing to deal with.
That's a good point.
And yeah, it removes that ugly world of finance and negotiation into the hands of someone else. It is not very appealing to do. I mean, I'm a guy who writes books about ethics, and the most recent book you talked about is a collection of essays, two areas that my agent consistently tells me don't sell. So I let him deal with the publisher.
Well, I was just going to ask you then, how is the book doing?
But perhaps it's doing fine. It's doing fine.
That's a good answer. Well, finally, let me ask you this. Given the felicity that writers have with words, do you think that we may be more inclined to stretch the truth than other people just because we think we could get away with it?
Looking around,
I'm not even
the
saying
room,
lies. I'm just stretching the truth. Is there
no, a... I think as if you're talking about writers mm-hmm. or people, I think what writers have a gift for is telling a story, and I think that some people make that interpretation that telling a story somehow means making something up. I think the best journalists tell a fascinating story, or the best writers of nonfiction books tell a fascinating story. Fiction books as well, they're making stuff up, but nonfiction writers who do very well tell great stories. And I think there's a story I write about, a column I wrote about that's in the Right Thing book, about a guy named Steve Denning, who was the knowledge officer. I'm still not exactly sure what a knowledge officer is, but he's a knowledge officer. And he was the knowledge officer for the World Bank, and he was trying to explain to the people at the World Bank why they needed to get all of their information in one central source on a computer so that it became accessible to all of them. And he was using these PowerPoint presentations and charts and diagrams where things went up and went down, and nobody was giving him any approval for anything. So then he decided he was going to tell the story of a doctor in a remote area in Africa that was trying to get information to treat a disease of a young patient in the hospital. And he looked it up, the information on the internet, found it right away, was able to make a decision and cure the child. And right away, the people at the World Bank gave him the money he needed for his project, and he decided then that telling stories was the way to get his message across. And I think he's actually since left. He wrote a book called The Springboard about telling stories, and he's since left the World Bank, and he's now helping other people tell stories. So I think what writers do well and have a propensity for, good writers, is to tell stories. That doesn't mean they should be... that doesn't mean we're making stuff up.
And at the same time, too, it doesn't mean that it has to be the complete story from every angle. You have to tell your story,
right,
in your way.
Well, we make choices. We make choices partly driven by space limitations, a lot driven by audience. I mean, we always make choices when we decide what to write. The piece that I write for the Sunday Money and Business section would be different from the piece that I might write for a men's magazine or a women's magazine because the audience is different and the tone is different. So we make those choices all the time as writers about what to include and what not to include.
The reason I'm asking that line of questions is because when the scandals, the recent scandals have broke, as you described, certainly for me it was an opportunity to examine the work that I've done myself and wonder, have I always done the right thing? And I think that, you know, responsible people do ask those questions, as we've discussed, and probably you can be overly concerned. You can almost be paralyzed, and you don't want that. You want to tell your story as completely as possible.
I think you're right.
And let time and other people judge it.
I think you're right, but I think that most good writers I know do agonize over whether they've gotten that fact exactly right as a piece is going to press. I mean, it is... I mean, I know I do. I mean, I worry about if I've spoken to somebody for a long period of time and it's a column that I write, I'm taking pieces of what they said out. So I often call them back, but as the piece is going to press, you know, on that Friday before the Sunday paper comes out, I have concerns that I don't want to, I didn't misrepresent something. I think if you do your homework, you don't really end up with that problem. But I think all of us agonize from time to time about where we're really getting something.
And especially right now, I think there's a kind of defensiveness that I feel personally, I know colleagues do. You know, it's easy to attack you know, historians and journalists and so forth. They're all making it up. And that's painting very broadly a profession that doesn't deserve that at all. It's unfair, really, to assume that because... And it's rather like... I mean, we know about the business scandals, but as you have pointed out, even if you rattle off 10 names of companies that have been embroiled in scandal, there are still how many? 15,000 public companies in this country.
There's somewhere between 14,000 and 16,000 public companies registered with the SEC, so that's a lot of companies, many of which haven't been found to be doing anything wrong, although people respond to me usually by saying, give it time. I think the vast majority of companies are not corrupt. I think it's fair for people. I think it's fair for people to read things skeptically. I think that that's good. I think that you want people who are critical thinkers. You don't want people to accept things as at face value. You'd like to think that people were doing that before many of the scandals broke among journalists. That it's good to be skeptical. That's not a negative thing. That just means you're thinking for yourself. You're taking the information in, and you're thinking for yourself. That's good.
Well, thank you very much,
sure,
Jeff.
Sure.
I want to turn now to Holly Hughes, talking on a subject close to her about photography books and some trends there. It's a very special niche piece of the publishing business, one that we're all familiar with, particularly at the holiday season. Holly Stewart Hughes is the editor-in-chief of Photo District News, which is really considered the international business publication, the Bible for the professional photographer's profession. PDN covers legal and legislative developments, new technologies, design and advertising trends, and the publishing world. In 1995, Holly and her staff won the Neal Award for Outstanding Editorial Achievement, awarded by the American Business Press for their coverage of copyright infringement and image appropriation. And they won a second Neal Award in 2002 and have also been honored by the National Press Photographers Association. Welcome, Holly. I want to start off with just asking you about a very important piece of the creative business, which is coming up with ideas. I think that's probably the easiest part, the ideas themselves, I mean, but actually selling them is an entirely different matter. And perhaps you can talk about some recent unusual successes in photography books in the coffee table book line and how they may, in fact, offer some lessons to people who would be thinking about publishing a book either in whole or in part of photography.
Well, as you said, photography books are definitely a niche market. I think that publishers who take a risk on a book that's primarily, where the content is primarily photographs, I think they feel pleased if they sell about 5,000 copies. Most photography books, depending on production values, can also be very, very costly. I mean, there's a reason that some of the favorite coffee table books you want to buy this Christmas are about $75 or more. That said, I think that there have been some interesting successes where photographers are looking beyond just trying to put their life's work between covers for posterity. That is kind of it's a dream of every photographer. It's a great legacy, but I think that does tend to go to the specialized market of people who are interested in photography books. I think success depends on breaking out of that niche. Sometimes that means creating a gift book that maybe you've sacrificed a little on the production of your photographs or the print quality in order to make it a book that might sell for less than $30 and will be those kind of impulse buys that that you buy on your way to grandmother's house for the holidays when you're passing by the checkout counter at Barnes & Noble or Borders. I think that an important thing to think about is photographers are all great storytellers, and they're all in the market of pitching great story ideas to magazines or to newspapers with, a photo essay idea. So I think they're very good at coming up with creative ideas or looking back on their archive and finding a great story within the body of their work they've taken over many years. But it's interesting to think about, is there a kind of a base here? We've done stories, for example, about sort of interesting photo books that, for example, one on the American Pit Bull, I think you were asking me about. Don't laugh, there's a lot of American Pit Bull owners in the United States, and if you know someone who's got an American Pit Bull, it's likely they're going to want a picture of some of the most beautiful examples of the breed and other owners. There's a real appeal right now for books of Americana. There's always an interest in travel books. I'm not surprised your history of Massachusetts was your choice. So something where there's a kind of a built-in audience of people beyond just people who are going to want a beautiful art object, but maybe there's... we've seen recent successes. I'm thinking of some of Joyce Tennyson's recent books. She did a book called Wise Women. They're just portraits, but they're portraits of senior citizens, of beautiful older women. And I think she touched on a real need we have in society to see elegant and respectful portraits of older citizens.
What about quirky humor? Is there a market for that? And what works? What has worked recently?
Well, I think what you really want me to talk about is a new book called Passing Gas,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
You want me to talk about a book by Gary Gladstone, who's an experienced travel and corporate photographer over the years, who in the course of his travels, he'd passed many times through Intercourse, Pennsylvania, and I'm forgetting some of the other goofy towns. One of the towns was called Gas, and he realized as he drove out of town, he had just passed Gas. So... like many photographers, he spent his free time in lulls between assignments, kind of seeking these places out, or he'd work his travel arrangements on assignment around to use his a little extra time at the end to get in some portraits of the people who lived in this town. The sweet thing about that story, actually, is that I think he thought it would be strictly a humor book. It would be sort of goofy pictures of these towns with goofy names. It'd be kind of a novelty book. In the end, he actually discovered that he actually loved these towns, and the people he met were incredibly charming. And lo and behold, this book that he produced really tapped into a kind of America nostalgia for small town at a time that the book-buying public was really interested in that. I'm sure also, I mean, he had a very surprising success achieving publicity, which is always a very important part of selling any book, and he also had just great, really startling sales. I can't help thinking that at least one person in every one of the towns that he passed through bought a copy of the book. But he just got a phenomenal amount of newspaper coverage, radio interviews for that book.
It really hit a nerve. And before we talk about the publicity piece of it and the responsibility that has fallen to all creators, photographers as well as writers, to publicize their own work, what I read was that for him, this was a way to escape what had become the drudgery of his work, that he was looking on the commercial photography that he had been doing as a kind of a box that he was in. He wanted to think outside that box. And you mentioned something else that perhaps we could discuss, and that is having a pet project, something that if you're going to be either writing or taking pictures, for a living, you are always focused on what's going to pay right now, you know, the next contract. But it's really helpful, I think, to have something that you're doing because you enjoy it, because it gives you a release, because maybe down the road it'll blossom into something.
Well, it better be a subject that you're interested in, because the process of bringing a book to fruition from initial idea to bound copy is going to be a long one. You're going to be working with that material for a long time. So one hopes it's a subject that you're interested in. But yeah, I think that's a common story among photographers. There's always limitations and frustrations when you're working on assignment. You're coping with the needs of your clients and the demands or last minute changes of a pesky art director or photo editor. But sometimes photography can bring you to a great place, an interesting place, and there's more that you want to explore, or it takes you to a great place that you want to know more about, and you use your photography to find it out. I mean, of course, another part of what's going on in why book photography is so is something that so many photographers aspire to is because there's fewer and fewer markets for long-term photo essays. And it can be very frustrating to work on a project, to be involved in a story that you're interested in, see one single image appear in a magazine, or just a few of your images appear with a story, not necessarily the pictures you would have chosen, or not necessarily in a layout you would have liked. And a book gives you a chance to really run with a story and explore something in depth.
Well, it struck me when you said that. I'm reading a book right now about the life of Robert Capa. And in his day, in Paris, there would have been, I don't want to exaggerate, but perhaps in more than a dozen photo essay publications of one kind or another, weekly or monthly, the sort of versions of life and look and so forth that would have begged for the kinds of images that he took during the Civil War and so forth and so on. All of that's gone, and the opportunity for photographers to develop and to see the work as more than a single image really has shrunken tremendously, and that must be very frustrating for them.
I guess it's not frustrating for people who photograph celebrities, since that's what occupies an awful lot of our magazines, but for travel, for a lot of other kinds of photographers, it's disappointing, yeah.
So, if you really are going to be ambitious about your profession as a photographer, then getting to a book is just that much more important.
I think the ambition part of it. I think a little bit of it of interest in book publishing is inspired by frustration, as I said, frustration with the limitations or short form of current magazines. But the ambition is really that publishing your book can be a long and frustrating process, and it's not, as you pointed out, you're not going to make a lot of money on it. But it's a great promotional device for photographers. It gives them great entree. There are many stories of photographers who are trying to get access to a place that might be usually off limits to professional photographers or photojournalists. Maybe they are going to have to go and photograph a really annoying subject, or some demanding celebrity or CEO, and it kind of woos them to show that, well, look, I'm a published photographer. I'm not a Johnny come lately. I have this body of work, and it's also something photographers use their books, sending them out to prospective clients or current clients as gifts and as a promotion to say, this is this direction in my work, this is what I really want to do, and here's where my real passion is.
Well, the commitment to getting the book together is more than just taking the photographs, though, and what PDN has covered pretty thoroughly over the last few years is the involvement that photographers really have to have today, from the beginning of the design work to the very end when it's being printed. Can you talk about some of the major milestones along the way and just identify them for people so they know what to expect?
Well, of course, as I said, I mean, a great idea, not just a great idea for a story, but some sense of who the potential audience would be. The thing is that mainstream publishers, if you walk into a mainstream publisher with a sort of loose box of your prints and say, you know, here's my life's work, it's hard to imagine that there are very many editors in book publishing with the expertise to even know where to begin to edit the photos down. And also photographers are usually bad editors of their work. But the less you take the risk out of the process for the publisher, the more likely you are to get that book published, which really means not just showing up with an idea for a book, but really working with a designer that you trust to bring in a completed dummy, some sense of the length, some sense of what kind of production you would need, and also to really show them almost complete what that would look like. You might want to work with a writer or contact someone to provide text, provide introduction, provide a foreword, get some name recognition onto the cover of the book. That's a big selling point. And also to be thinking about your book, it's really up to the photographer also, I think, to think about the book in the broadest possible way as a real project that may have many selling points. Not just the book, but the possibility of an exhibition, which would generate more publicity or more interest in the book. The possibility of connecting it to some kind of lecture series, if it's of a historical nature, educational nature. I don't know, the tourism industry, if that's the nature of the book, something like that.
So you really have to be focused at the very end, even from the beginning, which is how to sell the book.
Right. Or it's just, there's just too many book projects out there. And as I said, the costs of publishing a photo book just make it very risky for publishers.
So. Can you give us an idea of what that would be? A sense. I suppose it depends on the book itself.
Yeah, I don't know.
I read somewhere that some photographer had invested something like $24,000 of his own money to see a book to print.
Well, it is usually the photographer's responsibility to get the best possible prints made and the best possible scans delivered to the production department of the publisher. So right there, that's a cost. And really, how much investment you put into the book really kind of depends on how much creative control you want. If this is really your baby and you really want to see your pictures produced the way you first saw them or the way you labored over them at the lab, then you're probably going to invest some money into going on press. And if you're lucky, your publisher might be using a press that's in, say, northern Italy. And if you're not so lucky, they're going to be on press someplace less glamorous or where the coffee isn't as good. But that's usually on your dime to travel to wherever that is and to spend those days looking at page proofs and checking color and checking reproduction.
Let me ask you one last question, which I know is something of a real passion for you, and that is about copyright for photographers and maintaining the rights to their work. For somebody who's not a photographer herself, tell us why you care about that so deeply when you look out at the profession.
I like that picture of myself as being passionate about copyright. Well, we're sitting at the Constitution Center. I guess the long answer, I could say that I'm passionate about lots of things that the framers of the Constitution thought were worthwhile to write down in the Constitution, including the advancement of useful arts and sciences and providing rights of ownership for authors in a monetary incentive for them to benefit from their work, as copyright law protects. But I think, well, it's also about self-interest, is my interest in copyright. I'm the editor of a magazine that serves the professional photography business. And unless all authors and artists protect their copyright and the residual rights to their work, there isn't going to be a photography business. There will still be people who want to take snapshots, but no one's going to make any money on it. I guess I should explain the way that the photography business works. The majority of our readers are freelance, they're independent contractors. They make their living by creating pictures, usually on assignment. They hold the rights to that work, they license it to the client for a set amount of time, and then they re-license it to somebody else for another use, an advertising use, an editorial use, use in a textbook or on the internet, whatever. And for professional photographers, copyright is their equity and it's their pension plan. As long as we're talking about book publishing, there's a couple books coming out right about now, one we're writing about, by some real veteran photographers who have great pictures. One I'm thinking of is this Hollywood legendary photographer, Phil Stern, and he has great pictures from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s of film stars and stuff. And this guy, he's in his 80s, and he continues to make a living off of pictures that he took in the 40s. He took a picture, say, of some young, unknown, skinny actor. He turns out to be James Dean. He has loads of pictures like this. Over the years in Phil Stern's career, he's never signed away more than single use in magazines. He's always held the rights to his work. He's never let some Hollywood publicist, as happens now, dictate the terms of how he uses those photos. He's never signed them away to a studio that hired him. And so Phil Stern says, when any one of these Hollywood stars kicks, people know to come to him. He's the sole owner of the copyrights to these really great, iconic images. And he's never diminish the value of those images by letting other people have the rights to them. He's a sole proprietor, and he can now produce a beautiful, he's produced many books over the years, but he's produced a beautiful book of that work. And these people who have kind of scrappily and sometimes contentiously made an investment in protecting their work and their ownership to their work, for them, copyright really fulfills its original purpose, which is to provide a lasting source of income for the artists who put their work and their time and their energy and their into their intellectual property.
And that's a real, I think, a business person's rule. You don't want to give up something that you could make money on later. Thank you, Holly. I'd like to turn now to Crystal Brent Zook, who I think occupies a very interesting place here at the podium. She is a writer who works both in the academic world and in what I'll call the public media world, and we'll talk about her views on that. She is a scholar and journalist who has written about popular culture, race, gender, and politics for over a decade, with her work appearing in the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, the Village Voice, LA Weekly, Savoy, Emerge, and many other publications. She's currently a contributing writer for Essence and an adjunct professor in the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. Her first book, Color by Fox, The Fox Network and the Revolution in Black Television, was published by Oxford University Press in 1999. And welcome, Crystal, to Beyond the Book. And what I'd like to talk to you about first is how that book, Color by Fox, did come to be, because it really sums up your existence in, as I say, two very different kinds of worlds. You studied at the University of California, Santa Cruz in culture studies and left ABD, as they say, all but dissertation, to become a freelancer in Los Angeles. And maybe you want to pick up the story there and tell us how the work you did ended up coming back to provide you not only with a dissertation, but with a book that's been so well received.
Mm-hmm. I think that the key was trying to make my work accessible. I was always interested in writing about the politics of culture, the politics of television and film, but for, you know, just a regular reader, not necessarily an academic person. So when I went back to LA, I started actually reporting, not realizing that I was reporting on what was happening in television, black television at the time, and noticing patterns based on, you know, my scholarly work in cultural studies, but noticing patterns as far as who owned the networks, who was behind the actual production of these shows. And I noticed that suddenly the majority of black shows on TV were now being produced, written, and directed by African Americans, which had never happened before in the history of television. All those old shows from the 70s, like Good Times and, you know, Sanford and Son or whatever, those weren't black productions, actually. They just had black stars. So I became really interested in, so what does that mean to just the average person watching television? Because another pattern was that at the time, African Americans were 44% of network TV watchers. So that was a really interesting dynamic to me. There's several reasons, but basically because back then the new technology back then of VCRs and cable were sort of a middle class, you know, phenomenon, and black viewers who were disproportionately working class were still watching. They were the ones left behind, still watching free TV, right, network television. So I noticed this pattern that was. It seemed to me to be very tangible and accessible to, you know, a mainstream audience. What was going on? It didn't have to be confined to an academic discussion, right? So.
But your training, it's fascinating because I think your training helped you identify those patterns,
right?
And yet a kind of personal inclination to want to reach as wide an audience as possible led you to write about it in a certain way. And there you were in Los Angeles, you told me, with just fabulous access to the creators themselves.
Right. So I started asking the creators themselves what they were trying to do and how this was different from those earlier shows, you know, like the Jeffersons. And I found that it was different creatively and politically. They had actual agendas they were trying to put through. They were, you know, creating shows that dealt with gang violence, with AIDS, with poverty, with unemployment, all kinds of issues, and they were having struggles behind the scenes. And the average viewer didn't know about these struggles and didn't know, you know, why there were certain shows being produced that you never actually saw, and I got to see them, the pilots that didn't make it. So all this was fascinating, and I just basically was reporting and started pitching my ideas to the LA Weekly, which is where I started as a freelancer, and the Village Voice, and because they were timely. And so I guess as a journalist, I talk to academics a lot about the need to understand how to translate these issues into a popular press or mainstream audience. And one of the keys is you have to find a news peg. There has to be some sort of hook that, you know, something happening right now that makes these academic ideas timely. So the news peg was basically that the Fox Network, which is the main network I was writing about, canceled the majority of its black produced shows in 1994 in one fell swoop, just four of its six shows just gone, and didn't even bother to tell the producers that their shows were being canceled. Basically, they picked up the rights to NFL, you know, football, and sort of shifted their interest in who the audience was now going to be. It was now going to be a more mainstream audience as opposed to a disproportionately black audience. So, to that moment and what was going on in terms of news. So there you see how the academic issues, you know, are translatable. Just about anything to do if you find the hook.
for people who are working and writing in the university environment, I mean, how common is it that they have ambitions like you did to if you will, break out? I mean, are they looking for that wider audience? Are they content with a smaller one? And for those who are looking for the opportunity to break out, who have what they think is a news peg, beyond that, how should they approach the writing? Were you concerned at first yourself that you must have been writing a way that was appropriate for, you know, the research and the university, but appropriate for the LA Weekly? Did you have to readjust your work?
Yeah, I did. My first book review I ever wrote for the LA Weekly was just red marks all over it. A very kind editor who stuck with me and worked with me. And she just basically said this is too academic. But she was a wonderful editor. The LA Weekly was one of those places where they really worked with you on ideas and on the basis of, you know, the strength of your ideas. And it's hard to find editors like that now, I find. But the alternative media does have them. So I worked and worked to make my voice more accessible. And I do find that I do these workshops for academicians who want their work to be more accessible. And I find there's a real desire for that.
It would seem that, you know, we have our universities, and they are, by definition, you know, collections of tremendous minds, people who really have the opportunity and the time and inclination to think through their ideas. Mm-hmm. And yet, apart from occasional television chat shows, they don't get much of an opportunity to tell us about it.
And it's amazing how, I mean, there's a wealth of knowledge. Just if you, say, take someone who does science, they know all about the latest research. They know about the latest studies. This is a news peg in and of itself, but it doesn't necessarily get out there in a way that's translatable to a wider audience unless they or someone, you know, covering that beat gets it out. So what, you know, what I tell people in the workshops, there are a lot of tricks. There are a lot of ways for sort of connecting to the world. But first, you have to want to connect to the world. And that's, of course, that's been the critique of the Ivory Tower. Some people who are, you know, and that's fine. I think, Chris, you put it to me in a really nice way. You said if you want to study the intricacies of a butterfly wing, just for the sake of knowing what it is, then that's a wonderful thing. But if you want to study it and be able to tell the rest of the world about the beauty of that thing, that's a different agenda.
And related to other things beyond the subject itself.
Right, related in a way that's relatable to, you know, a broader public. So there are lots of tricks. I mean, basically, it's training yourself to be engaged with what the rest of the world is doing, and then applying what you find there to your own research, which may be more specialized, and that's fine. But I guess I'll give one example. When someone also at the LA Weekly told me when I was first starting, she said, "Do you read Publishers Weekly?" And I didn't at the time. And I mean, this is just a wonderful tool for people in any field, because you see what, you know, it's a trade publication, you see what forecasts are, what books are coming out. If they're books in the arts, books in the sciences, you can sort of apply what other people are doing and, you know, what you might write as a possible book review to your own work. So, I mean, it's invaluable to connect in that way, or to just, if you're in the arts, to know what the new museum openings are going to be 3 months from now, or 6 months from now if you're doing magazine writing, because the lead time for magazines is very, very long. If you're pitching an idea about a museum opening, it helps, you know, someone in the arts has an in, because they have a friend who's going to have an opening 6 months from now that other people may not know about. And so you...
Right. And I think sort of keeping an eye on the news is a good point as well. although you can overdo it, I suppose. And there are certain subjects. Holly was telling me that in photography books, Cuba is the big rage right now. Certainly, I would think if you were an Islamicist at a university, you might be tempted to want to put together a popular book about that, although that moment may have passed itself. It's very difficult. You have to have some kind of a crystal ball, and maybe also just good luck.
Right. We both attended that seminar, how to make six figures, and it was just good luck.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think you have to go on instinct, and the idea of having a pet project really resonated with me, because you sort of keep that here. I have all these different folders with pet projects all over the house, and you never know when one of them is going to become timely, but you just sort of keep putting your notes into each folder, and it's something that you believe in. Maybe no editor does right now, but at some point there will be a newspaper, or there'll be a hook, or something will happen, and you just pull that folder out.
Well,
but you
right.
to follow your own instinct.
And I think you're faced with that dilemma right now. You've been doing some essays for Essence, and you want to turn them into a book, but you haven't quite figured out yet how to do it. Can you talk about the thinking that you've been going through? And I know it's still an ongoing process, but
right.
share with us just how you face that challenge right now.
Right. It's sort of an anecdote from the publishing industry that may or may not be good news, but it actually started out as essays for my book that I turned some of them around as pieces for a magazine when the book didn't end up happening. So they were published in Essence after I had researched them for this book. And basically, when you have ideas for individual essays, I've been told by publishers, they don't necessarily, cohere as a book. And this is a big problem. How do you find that narrative thread that's gonna make it work as one whole unit? And so I ran into some different opinions. I had publishers who thought that this was a book about black feminism, or wanted it to be a book about black feminism. And to me, as I was writing and reporting, I found that the women I was interested in weren't interested in feminism, yet their lives were about gender struggles and gender dynamics, but I couldn't put that format onto them, superimpose it onto their lives. So that narrative thread didn't work. And now we're just sort of faced with a whole bunch of essays that work really well as essays, but what is the thread that unites black women's lives, the stories that I'm talking about in these essays? So you do have to find, I guess the moral is you have to find a narrative thread that you and your editor can agree on. And that's one perspective, point of view that carries you through. And that's what makes the difference between a book and a magazine piece.
Well, good luck with that struggle. And we'll look forward to seeing the book when it happens. And finally, I think appropriately, I want to talk to Paul Dry, who comes to us from really just down the street here in Philadelphia. Paul started Paul Dry Books in 1998 after many years of trading stock options on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. At first, he published books that he had read and loved, but which had gone out of print since he first read them. Today, though, Paul is publishing new writing from around the world in English translation, as well as reprints. And his catalog ranges widely from poetry and fiction to essays on Plato, a book called The Verb to Bird, which is nonfiction on the happy and sometimes wacky world of birders. And I want to welcome from Philadelphia Paul Dry to the panel here.
Thank you, Chris.
And talk about something that intrigues me, which is that publishing is a second career for you. And it grew out of working in a book club, but being a part of a book club and somehow being inspired to want to create books. Talk about that.
Well, that's a bit daunting since my wife and friend are here, both of whom are in the book club. So I may be
You're not going to be
able to tell all of the truth.
Just make it a good story.
That's good advice. When we started the book club, which was in 1986, we were generally in our mid to late 30s, and I think we needed conversation. And so the book, reading the book, was a cause to get together and converse. And then I think what happened for many of us was the conversation was an excuse to read the book. That is, it got confusing. Were we meeting to read or were we reading to meet? And I think that was a fertile confusion because it kept us going. We're still meeting. The interesting thing about a book group, my experience, was that I began to hear other perspectives. Now, here's the problem of truth in telling the story. My wife and friend might say that I'm not a good listener in the book group, but you can't help but hear how other people read, and the book becomes more rounded and fuller, and the great book really holds up, and it exists in your imagination, as I don't think it would have if you hadn't talked about it with others. So it creates that multiple perspective, not that, oh, well, you take the book this way, I take the book that way, but as one reader, you begin to walk around the book in a kind of creative way, not to brag about oneself, but the book just has so much more dimension. And that gave me the confidence that I could read a book and imagine how others would read it. And one would hope, find a book or a manuscript that would be interesting to other people whose interests were different than mine, but who could share an affection for a kind of writing.
Well, what's intriguing about this is that while we're here talking about the creating business, I think somehow it all comes back to reading. Whatever the subject, whatever kind of book it is, you have to love to read.
Yeah, and I think we all do one way or the other. The latest book we published is a very small book, fittingly small since it's called So Many Books, Reading and Publishing in an Age of Abundance. I want to read two or three sentences from it because I think it's precisely about the question you ask. Here are the first two sentences. The reading of books is growing arithmetically. The writing of books is growing exponentially. If our passion for writing goes unchecked, in the near future, there will be more people writing books than reading them. And then later in this opening piece, the author goes on to say, Gabriel Zaid is the author, reading liberates the reader and transports him from his book to a reading of himself and all of life. It leads him to participate in conversations and in some cases to arrange them as so many active readers do, as parents, teachers, friends, writers, translators, critics, booksellers, librarians, promoters. That's the claim I think reading has on me, and, you know, I'm a reader, I've become a publisher in the last 4 years. We're all many things, but one thing for sure is we're hopeful readers in search of the book that will liberate us from what we think of as the limited quotidian life we have.
Well, yeah, in fact, there's an interesting triangle here of creator, writer, photographer, publisher, and reader. And as I was pondering that, I thought that probably more often than they should, the creators think of themselves as publishers. They put themselves in that place rather than putting themselves in the place of the reader. And there's a big difference there. And that they should probably think more of themselves as readers than be worried about what is an editor going to like, is this going to be right for this publisher?
Well, at the risk of disagreeing, I think really good writers always hear their writing in some way. And they're good to the extent that they're the listeners of their own writing. On the other hand, they can't do the job of publisher, or if they can, then while they're doing that job, they're not an author. A publisher, it seems to me, has to exercise some combination of judgment and taste to select a manuscript that he or she wants to root for. And then the next phase is that rooting and enthusing. And you do that by shaping the book so you think you can present it to the world in as attractive fashion as possible and find the likely readers for that piece of writing. So publisher, whether he also happens to be the author or also happens to be some other player in this triangle, the publisher's job is to exercise judgment and taste about the writing and then fashion it in a package that he can enthuse about. And
you also have to find an audience, too, don't you?
Well, that's right. That enthusing means you have to find the likely readers. The thing about the discussion of success for a book implies somehow that every book is going to have a huge market, huge readership, and if it doesn't, it's a failure. In this book by the Mexican Zaid, he mentions a book translated into English, which was The Labyrinth of Solitude by Octavio Paz, for which the writer essentially won the Nobel Prize. In the first 10 years of publication, that book sold 1,000 copies. It was a failure, clearly, from a publishing point of view. And it eventually became the central book in the opus of this Nobel laureate. Now, not all books that sell only 1,000 copies in 10 years will bring the Nobel Prize to their author. But it seems to me success in publishing has to be measured by this elusive gauge. Did the author and publisher find the likely readers for the book? And not all books have millions of readers. Some have rather small markets, and of course some have large markets. The wonderful thing about books is that they can exist with small markets. You don't need to find 1 million readers for a book to get published and find its likely readers. That's different with a movie. Movies need big markets. TV shows need bigger markets than books and probably smaller markets than movies.
Right. The cost of publishing itself, I mean, apart from very high-end coffee table books, as we've talked before, that could be very expensive and retail for $75, the cost of publishing a book such as so many books is, relatively speaking, low. It's the cost of reading it and finding the time that's become so high today. Is that fair?
Well, that's right. If a book costs $15 and you're a lawyer or doctor earning money at the rate of $250 to $500 an hour, then the purchase of the book is trivial, but the 10 hours of time or 5 hours of time spent to read it begins to look pretty expensive. When you think about the production of a book, yes, I mean, the physical cost of making a little book isn't very much, but there was the time spent finding the book, the time spent reading it, rereading it, thinking about it, then editing it, elaborating with the author the best way to package it. That's a cost that I suppose typically is called overhead. But it's another thought would be to call it opportunity cost. While you're looking at one book, you're not focused on another book. But the reason small presses can exist is precisely because it doesn't cost a great deal of out-of-pocket cash to publish a book. That's not the problem. The problem is, once you've done it, now you've got a daunting task to find readers who will make the job worthwhile both economically and emotionally, because nobody wants to send books into the world that aren't read.
Well, I was going to ask you about how you feel, you know, that world, apart from being full of readers that you're trying to grab by the elbow and drag them over to the book, is a world today that's dominated by giant publishing conglomerates who put out catalogs that seem to be built around anticipating the next big thing or market research or anything but what we think, perhaps, goes into making a great book. And I contrast that with your own catalog, which I think of as being a glimpse of an individual bookshelf by comparison. And that really is a... It pits you, what will make it heroic. You're the David in the world of Goliaths there. Is that how you see it? Is it how daunting is it for you? And is it about, I think you told me, putting your taste and your enthusiasm up against their clout and their money?
Oh, dear, I hope I didn't say that. Because I think the big publishing firms are as daunted by their task, too. They have a lot more overhead. They have a lot more commitment. They've got... big payroll they have to meet every week, and so they've got to sell these books. The trick for any marketer, and I think that's what we've heard, is how do you find your readers? The truth is we're all readers here. All of you are writers and photographers, but for sure we're all readers, and we're all busy swatting away advice that people give us about, oh, you ought to read this book or that book. Why? Because we have a very elaborate sifting system of what we're going to read and who are we going to listen to. I have friends who, when they recommend a book, I ignore. I don't know why, but I seem to ignore them. Other friends, they could whisper at midnight, gee, you ought to take a look at this book, and the next morning I want to get a copy of it. It is a problem finding readers, but as readers, we find it a problem finding the books we love. I think that's just the nature of things. I don't think we should bemoan it. America's an amazing place, you know. You've invited me here. Thank you. I mean, I don't see the representative of Random House, but he might be here. There are an awful lot of opportunities to reach people, and we just have to be energetic and not get discouraged when we don't. Because, in fact, we know we're busy walking by things that, gee, later we wish, I should have stopped and listened. That was interesting. So it's just, there are so many opportunities to make contact, and that's what we have to focus on.
Well, I want to close this part of the program by referring to a favorite line of mine from Benjamin Franklin. It's up on the wall there. It's either write something worth reading or do something worth writing. And that seems to me to be the best kind of advice for anybody in the creative field. Thank you all for a really wonderful discussion. We'll be back in just a few moments with questions and answers from our audience.
Thank you.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.